can be no more hurt, only more love. And Bob Marley said, one love, one heart, one destiny. If you want to share Encouragementology with a friend who needs to know they're not alone in this journey of self-discovery, you can visit Encouragementology.com or anywhere you stream your content to receive this episode and all others. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram for additional encouragement throughout the week. So I challenge you to activate joy in your life. It resides in your heart, and you can share it with others through acts of service. Active joy illuminates your life and draws others to you. I know you can do it. Thank you for listening to Encouragementology with Kendall Boyson, where we find positive ways to handle some of life's challenges.
I stumbled through until the path was clear. That's when I found you, how I wound up here. All I needed was a rock that I could lean on.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is listener-sponsored. That's right. 80% of our funding comes from donations from listeners just like you. You can always make a donation to help keep KBOO independent and non-commercial at kboo.fm/give. Right now, during our end-of-year drive, is the perfect time to contribute. Give now and help us reach our goal of $70,000 by December 31st. Make your tax-deductible year-end donation at kboo.fm/give today.
Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, the nonstop fight to free political prisoner and American Indian Movement founder Leonard Peltier kicked up a notch today as Peltier's supporters take to the streets to call for his immediate release. Also, the draconian era, Trump era Title 42 remains in place under order of Biden and his racist accomplice. Yeah, this is a racist system at Homeland Security. Well, there's a march going on. People are marching over 2,000 miles to call attention to the suffering at the border. We're going to talk to some of those marchers. We're going to find out what's going on at the border. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. I have a little trouble talking today, but we are here with you over the People's Network, the Pacifica Radio Network. And what a marvelous network it is, non-commercial, no holds barred, truth to power. We tell the truth where the networks hide. We're going to start with Leonard Peltier. Leonard Peltier is an Anishinaabe Lakota Native American activist imprisoned in the United States for over 46 years, serving two life sentences for murder without any direct evidence. Really, you study that, you go crazy. You understand the nature, the way in which genocide works against, continues to work against the indigenous communities. Peltier has always maintained his innocence, convicted by an all-white jury, including a judge and juror with admitted prejudice against American Indians. Peltier's lawyers and advocates continue to fight against a case that they say is riddled with racial bias prosecutorial misconduct, manufactured evidence, and false testimony. I could go on and on, but since my mouth isn't working well, we're just going to invite onto these airways one, our own senior producer, Miguel Gavilan Molina. Miguel, welcome back to the show. Good to have you with us back from L.A.
It's good to beat the drum today, Dennis. Let's do it.
Good to beat the drum. And joining us to beat that drum is Tony Gonzalez, Executive Director of AIM West. Tony, good to have you back. I know people were in the street today in San Francisco and around the globe. What was happening in San Francisco here in the Bay Area?
Well, thank you very much, Dennis Bernstein and Miguel Molina and all my relations. Today, indeed, in San Francisco, we had a good turnout of community people, indigenous peoples from throughout, to call on the Board of Supervisors of San Francisco to follow through with their resolution of February 24, 2022, where they also had declared a day of solidarity with Leonard Peltier to make that real, and that is also to urge him to call on the mayor of San Francisco, London Breed, to declare a proclamation for the release, immediate release of Leonard Peltier. At Dennis, and there were a lot of good speakers from Northern California, Edwina Lincoln, with Gloria Lariva from ANSWER Coalition, and of course, thanks to the support of Amnesty International here from the Bay Area. But all the efforts toward the release of Leonard Peltier have been underway momentously. The more recent declaration for the release of Leonard Peltier, that is in the form of a letter. U.S. senators have written a letter. Seven U.S. senators have written a letter calling for the release of Leonard Peltier, calling on President Biden, the only person that can release Leonard Peltier. And if I may mention those senators to our listeners, Dennis, that is Senators Tina Smith, Mozzie K. Rono, Patrick Leahy, Edward J. Markey, Bernard Saunders, Senator Brian Schatz, and by the way, Senator Brian Schatz is also the chair of the Indian Affairs Committee, whom all declare that Leonard should also be released from prison. And of course, Elizabeth Warren. And in that letter, they cited the wrongs toward addressing the wrongs on being committed by the U.S. government toward Native American peoples, and primarily, I would say, those incarcerated, and that also includes Leonard Peltier. So given the campaign to free Leonard Peltier with the longest walk that recently began September of this year, a walk of 1,100 miles to Washington, D.C. It culminated on November 13 there at the Capitol, and included among the speakers there on November 13, Dennis, included former federal prosecutor James Reynolds, who prosecuted Leonard Peltier and led the way for Leonard's incarceration today. And he was there also declaring freedom for Leonard Peltier, calling on President Biden to release Leonard Peltier immediately. So, you know, with that going on, plus I also want to add for our listeners to know that all these efforts are to create the attention for Biden to release Leonard Peltier. That in September, I believe it was, the Democratic National Committee, which represents over 70 million Democrats across the country, also unanimously wrote a letter to President Biden that Leonard Peltier must be released. So It's with that urgency. His medical health and condition is not good. So it's very urgent, Dennis, that our listeners go to the website for Leonard Peltier, who wants to know more about him, and that includes a movie documentary, My Life, Leonard Peltier, My Life. And the website is whoisleonardpeltier.info. And also at the rally for Leonard Peltier today in San Francisco, we are calling on people to call the White House and leave a message to President Biden to release Leonard Peltier, either with a executive clemency, a compassionate release, or a COVID-19 release. And that is area code 202-456-1111. So the group was energized, Dennis, I must say, at the rally today here in San Francisco.
Well, I'm energized by the actions that you've taken with the group, that AIM West has taken. I'm, again, always in shock, never get used to it, right? That the genocide that the United States government started, we know back when, is continuing, and we see it in situations like that where they continue to hold on to someone, a leader in the indigenous community who was clearly set up by the corrupt law enforcement in this country. You talk about, you know, when it comes to going after white people, they're a little slow. But they've got Peltier in jail for 40 years after manufacturing the evidence. So this is really a troubling case. And he should not be a Democrat, of all things. And forgive me, Tony and Miguel, of all things, a Democrat should not be responsible, should not be in office if this country's going to kill Leonard. Should Biden, is the blood of Leonard Peltier going to be on the hands of a Democrat? Come on now. Anyway, yes. Thanks for that, Tony. Gavilan, you want final comments? I'm sorry, Tony, go.
Yes, please, Dennis. I'd like to take our listeners back to that incident at the Jumping Bull compound on Pine Ridge Reservation on June 26, 1975. There were indeed two FBI agents that were killed, and that is Jack Kohler and also Ronald Williams. And these two men came onto the Jumping Bull compound in with malicious intent. Obviously, they came armed, and what ensued was already a military action by military police forces already on the move at that time. So it was under that stress. And even go back further for our listeners to recall, Wounded Knee, 1973, and for 71 days, the occupation there, the American Indian Movement, friends, supporters, all in solidarity that were there, surrounded by the U.S. Army, and thousands of rounds by the U.S. Army was concentrated on that camp. And after the 71 occupation, from 73 to 75, there were over 70 men and women that were killed on and near the Pine Ridge Reservation. And that particular period in time, from 73 after Wounded Knee to 75, is referred to as the Reign of Terror. And it was under that Reign of Terror and these killings that these two FBI agents come onto the Jumping Bull compound, knowing what the environment looked like. So, you know, the people have to go to the website, as I mentioned, whoisleonardpeltier.info, to know more details and then help us in this campaign to free Leonard Peltier. Keep the momentum going. We need that attention.
Thanks. Thanks, Tony Gonzalez. Miguel, you want to final comments on this? We're on the jump.
Just real quickly, and that's that, you know, back, I believe it was the Clinton administration, was actually considering making a decision before, you know, Clinton left office. But it never happened. And when the list came forward, Leonard's name wasn't on there. And that same year, there was over, I believe, hundreds of, on December 15th, over 500 FBI agents marched in front of the White House to oppose that clemency. So, you know, the FBI is still on this, and that's going to be a situation we're going to have to push back against. But I do have something here, just a quick, you know, something we can wrap this up with, and that's a message from Leonard in the spirit of Crazy Horse, and it reads like this. Silence, they say, is the voice of complicity, but silence is impossible. Silence screams. Silence is a message, just as doing nothing is an act. Let who you are ring out and resonate in every word, in every deed. Yes, become who you are. There is no sidestepping your own being or your own responsibility. What you do is who you are. You are your own commonplace. You become your own message. You are the message. In the spirit of Crazy Horse by Leonard.
Oh, in the spirit of Crazy Horse by Leonard. That's Miguel Gavilan Molina. He's a he's a Yaqui Chicano. And we've got Tony Gonzalez, who's the director of AIM West. We're talking about Leonard Peltier. I want to thank both of you for helping us to remember Leonard Peltier, this indigenous leader who has been persecuted by the United States government in the context of thousands of years of persecution. And it's got to stop, and it should stop with Leonard Peltier. So again, we're going to be on this story. We're never going to let it go. And we thank our brothers and sisters for keeping us apprised. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to go from here to the U.S.-Mexico border, where there is a over 2,000 mile trek taking place for civil and human rights, for the right to apply for asylum, for the right to be human. That's what's coming up next. Stay with us. There is a major witness taking place at the border by witness at the border and others who care about what's going on there, which is treachery, violence, and unbelievable suffering being put upon by people who are often fleeing wars and oppression created by U.S. Monroe policy in this hemisphere. That's what we're going to talk about again, because this program is devoted to telling the story and ending this suffering. And somebody who has been with us for quite a while now, really opening the door so we can understand what's going on, is our good friend, our brother, Camilo Perez Bustillo. Camilo Perez Bustillo. He has been helping to inform us now for, I guess it's almost getting on 2 years, maybe, Camilo. We sort of roped you in. We got you with us, and we can't let you go. Tell us about what's happening at that 2,000-mile trek. Why are people willing to walk over 2,000 miles?
Thanks so much, Dennis, and I'm honored to join you. And, you know, I'm here on behalf of Witness at the Border and of the National Lawyers Guild chapter here in the San Francisco Bay Area. Our office is on Cap Street. And what we're trying to do is connect the crisis in the communities of origin of migrants throughout Latin America that are knocking on the door at the U.S.-Mexico border, demanding recognition of their right to asylum and to protection and to humanitarian assistance, and who have been turned away, over 2 million turned away since the pandemic began in March of 2020, applying this policy called Title 42. I just came back from the border accompanying this caravan. I was there for the beginning of the caravan. We were reporting directly to you with Josh Rubin from Brownsville, you know, from the border at Matamoros, the eastern end of the border. Then I was with them all the way through our stop in Uvalde, Texas, meeting with the families who were victims of the bloody slaughter there, Robb Elementary School, when for 77 minutes, the Border Patrol and hundreds of other heavily armed agents from Homeland Security stood by and let those children die in one of the most tragic recent mass shootings. And then I was back at the border this past weekend at El Paso, where on Saturday, December 10th, we observed International Human Rights Day. Just as you highlighted the way in which International Human Rights Day around the world connects to cases like those of our brother Leonard Peltier and the demand that he be immediately freed, like Mumia Abu-Jamal and so many others unfairly incarcerated, it's also a day when we stood up in El Paso to remember, to commemorate the massacre that took place there. And this connects to Uvalde, of course. This is the El Paso massacre, which was when we began to, you know, be a guest on your program with Martin Espada, to try and urge that all of us recognize that what happened in El Paso in August 2019 was the product of the Trump administration's policies at the border. That's why we've undertaken this pilgrimage for justice. It will culminate this coming weekend, this caravan, in San Diego, Tijuana, on December 18th, which is International Migrants Day.
Wow. And tell us a little bit more about Witness at the Border. I know that's a group that you worked with in terms of trying to break down and put an end to these concentration camps where kids were being stored when they were being taken directly from their families and families were being broken up by Trump. Tell us a little bit about Witness for the and how people can find more about it and be a part of it if they want.
You can find us at Witness at theborder.org. There's a very active Facebook group of the same name, Witness at the Border, with over 18,000 participants. You can find us on Twitter. You can find us on TikTok now. You can find us on Instagram. And there's coverage constantly updated through those various social media of the caravan as it progresses. The caravan is dedicated to the defense of the right to seek asylum, to seek refuge, and the right to freedom of movement, the right to migrate for all those communities and countries in Latin America where daily life means the negation of the right to a dignified life. That's what we're trying to defend through the caravan. And what we're trying to say by making a stand at the border is that sadly, most of the most damaging policies of the Trump administration have been kept in place by the Biden administration, although there's been a change in rhetoric and sometimes in the possibility of people being admitted or not. But the bottom line is that Title 42 remains in place, which I mentioned, which was imposed at the beginning of the pandemic, and uses the pandemic as an excuse to turn back more than 2 million people. In effect, the right to asylum is being denied. The other thing that's crucial as we speak, as we look at the arc of crisis throughout Latin America, as we look at what's going on right now as we speak in Peru, what we have to understand is that the immediate consequences of U.S. foreign policy, of free trade, of the drug war, of ongoing intervention, of the Monroe Doctrine, as you mentioned, in this hemisphere is massive upheaval through forced migration and displacement. That's why tens of thousands of migrants in unprecedented numbers are at the U.S.-Mexico border, many of them from Venezuela, from Cuba, from Nicaragua, all three of which, of course, have been countries targeted by U.S. foreign policy, by sanctions, by interventions for most of the last century, and especially during the last two or three decades. And what we see is the cynical result where the U.S. produces instability and then refuses to pay the price of admission for those who are displaced because of that destabilization. And so that's why Venezuelans come, that's why Cubans come, that's why Nicaraguans come. It's the direct result of U.S. policy. The same is true on the other side of the ideological line, let's say, in Central America and in Haiti. And so in each of those countries, what we see is that the cost of U.S. policy is intensification of mass migration and instability. In Peru, we see that as we speak, where it is clearly U.S.-supported interests that promoted this coup that is unfolding as we speak, where the popularly elected president, the legitimate president, was detained and is under arrest as we speak. Pedro Castillo, who represented a center-left option in Peru, like the current president of Colombia or of Chile, or like Lula in Brazil. And the bottom line is that's intolerable for the U.S., and that's intolerable for the corporate interests that the U.S. is dedicated to defend, and which it uses the Monroe Doctrine as a shield to protect. And so what we see at the border is the fourth largest number after Venezuelans, after Cubans, after Nicaraguans at the border is folks from Peru, is Peruvians. And so it's very clear if we connect the dots. We have to look at what's going on in the countries of origin and how that's reflected directly at the border as we speak.
Absolutely. Those are the kind of geopolitics that are not reported upon in the U.S. corporate press. That becomes a real problem because these governments, some of the corrupt governments supported by the United States, get away with literally murder. We've seen this from Mexico all the way to the tip of Chile, based on the kind of U.S. foreign policy that sends people running. And this is the struggle as it is right now. We're just about out of time, Camilla, but just say a little bit more about what you would really like to see happen. What can be done? What can Mr. Mayorkas do from Homeland Security to make a difference? Is it possible? Is there a policy that we can institute that can change things, as they say?
You know, the Democrats have dug a hole for themselves, and that's what Mayorkas's failure represents and the Biden administration's failure. Sadly, the Democrats are in a crouch, in a defensive crouch on the issue of the border, and what they want to demonstrate to their Republican, adversaries, and to public opinion in general, is that they are going to toughen enforcement at the border. That's the nature of a bill that's currently being promoted in the Senate as we speak during this lame duck session, promoted by Senator Sinema of Arizona, who you've all heard a lot about in the last few days. She is promoting a bill with other colleagues in the Senate that would, in return for toughening enforcement at the border and denying asylum on a continuing basis, would in some ways soften policies towards DACA recipients, or at least those who've already applied for DACA, wouldn't extend DACA. So I think that's, we're seeing those kinds of trade-offs being discussed on the Hill. Meanwhile, people continue to suffer in the weather of the winter at the border and are being denied asylum and are living in the streets of Matamoros and of Tijuana and of Ciudad Juarez, and only, you know, limited numbers are being admitted, and only being admitted when Mexico will not take them or will not send them back. So here a key thing is the relationship between the U.S. and Mexico. So what we need is Latin American unity from Mexico through Argentina, especially with the new left-of-center governments that have been elected, so that there's a unified approach throughout the region, defending the right to freedom of movement, the right to asylum, and the right to refuge, and entering into a grand bargain with the U.S., saying, if you want to invest in our countries, if you want our labor, you have to admit our people, and you have to recognize their rights.
Best way to get information about Witness at the Border, what's going on now? Let's lay that out again for us, if you could.
WitnessAtTheBorder.org, and the group on Facebook of over 18,000 participants under the same name, Witness at the Border. You can also follow us here and follow the caravan at NLGSF.org, National Lawyers Guild San Francisco.org. Look us up, the National Lawyers Guild chapter in San Francisco. We are co-organizers of this effort, this caravan, and please follow us this weekend and support us as we stand for justice on International Migrants Day at the border between San Diego and Tijuana. And we'll update you, Dennis, of course, after that. Thank you.
We so much appreciate the information, the good work, the commitment of all those folks who have signed on for this ultimately over a 2,000-mile trek for human rights, for the right to apply for asylum. This is crucial to us. We care a lot about it. Be safe. Camilla, we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks so much, Dennis. We greatly appreciate your work. Thank you.
Thank you. And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We'll take a break. We'll be right back.
Going back to ancient Greece, it was said that in war, truth is the first casualty. Well, of course, we know there are many others. That goes back over 2,500 years. So as a species, we've been at it for quite a while. Samuel Johnson seems to have had a word on the matter too, going back to the 1750s. Among the calamities of war may be jointly numbered the diminution of the love of truth by the falsehoods which interest dictates and credulity encourages. That's in the 1750s, as I noted. Coming up into the 20th century, Hiram Warren Johnson, senator from California, progressive Republican and isolationist, right. He also said the first casualty when war comes is truth. There's a theme here. The U.S., of course, the United States has been at war with its neighbors, with peoples the world over that most can't find on a map, and with itself for nearly every year of its existence. The United States is an empire. Arundhati Roy wrote almost 20 years ago now, as the U.S. embarked on its war of terror, that people rarely win wars, governments rarely lose them. People get killed. Governments molt and regroup, hydra-headed. They use flags first to shrink-wrap people's minds and smother thought, and then as ceremonial shrouds to bury their willing dead. On all sides, she wrote both sides, Afghanistan as well as America, at the time, civilians are now hostage to the actions of their governments. Of course, there have been many that have warned us about the horrors of war along the way. At the outset of the Spanish-American War in 1898, with the annexation of the Philippines, we saw the creation of the Anti-Imperialist League. By 1928, after what was called the Great War, right, it wasn't called World War I yet, they weren't cynical enough to say, well, wait, next time it's going to be bigger and worse. The Great War spawned the Kellogg-Briand Pact, or the Pact of Paris, which basically was an effort to outlaw war. That hasn't been going so well. We were also warned by people in the military themselves, including one of the most decorated Marines in U.S. history, Smedley Butler. Many of you may know that upon retirement, Smedley Butler wrote a short book called War is a Racket. And I wanted to share a couple of brief quotes here before we bring Chris Hedges to the stage. Smedley Butler told us the truth about war. He said, I spent 33 years and 4 months in active military service, and during that period, I spent most of my time as a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street and the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism. He then lists long list of countries that he invaded and made secure for U.S. investments. Looking back on it, I might have given Al Capone a few hints, Butler said. The best he could do was to operate his racket in three districts. I operated on three continents. War is a racket. It always has been. It is possibly the oldest, easily the most profitable, surely the most vicious. It is the only one international in scope. It is the only one in which the profits are reckoned in dollars and the losses in lives. In short, Smedley Butler was telling us war was hell because he fought it and lived it and saw it up close, which is something that many of the United States politicians can't really say. They're abstract enthusiasts for empire. They don't see what it does. Well, tonight's guest has certainly seen what it does. In 2002, Chris Hedges published War as a Force That Gives Us Meaning, which the LA Times described as the best kind of war journalism. The New York Times even called it a brilliant, thoughtful, timely, and unsettling book. Well, Chris can maybe tell you what happened after that. In 20 years since, Hedges has not wanted to write another book on the subject of war until now, with the outbreak of the war in Ukraine. He says that it is important again to be reminded who are the victors of the spoils of war and of other unerring truths, not only in this war, but in all modern wars, where civilians are always the main victims and the tools and methods of war are capable of so much destruction it boggles the mind. This book, The Greatest Evil is War, is an unflinching indictment of the horror and obscenity of war by one of our finest war correspondents. Chris Hedges is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who was a foreign correspondent and bureau chief in the Middle East and the Balkans for 15 years for the New York Times. He previously worked overseas for the Dallas Morning News, the Christian Science Monitor, and NPR. Hedges, who holds a Master of Divinity from Harvard University, is the author of numerous books and was a National Book Critics Circle finalist for War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. He's taught at Columbia University, New York University, Princeton University, and University of Toronto, and actually teaches in the prison system in New Jersey. His new show is The Chris Hedges Report at the Real News Network. It's also at Substack, chrishedges.substack.com. Without further delay, please give a warm welcome to Chris Hedges.
Thank you.
What's that?
No, I'm going to read. Thank you very much. When I finished writing War as a Force That Gives Us Meaning, it was not cathartic. It was one of the most difficult things I did, I've ever done. There were days when I couldn't write. I would just cry all day. It was written out of my own experience as a war correspondent for 20 years. And it's not a memoir. In fact, I was quite deliberate in that every time I brought myself into that book, it was to expose a moral failing. I'd read enough memoirs by war correspondents to see how self-aggrandizing they were, and I didn't want to do that. And then the book, neither I nor the publisher, was a small publisher, thought it would sell. It did. It sold hundreds of thousands of copies. And then the big publishers, who have dollar signs in their eyes, wanted me to write another book on war, and I refused because I didn't want to dilute what I had done, and also because I didn't want to essentially narrow the focus of my writing to just produce one book on war after another. This book is different. It looks at the experiences of people who come out of war to describe, I think, some of the most salient points of what it is to be in war. One of the chapters I'm going to read is called Corpses. When the bodies come home, it's with a father whose 20-year-old Marine Corps son is killed, wounds that never heal. That's Thomas Young, who was a quadriplegic and then wrote the last letter. Actually, he couldn't hold a pen. He dictated it, and I wrote it out for him to Cheney and Bush before he was going to unhook his feeding tube and die. But I'm going to read two small sections of this book, and then we'll talk with Mickey about it. Preemptive war, whether in Iraq or Ukraine, is a war crime. It does not matter if the war is launched on the basis of lies and fabrications, as was the case in Iraq, or because of the breaking of a series of agreements with Russia, including the promise by Washington not to extend NATO beyond the borders of a unified Germany, not to deploy thousands of NATO troops in Central and Eastern Europe, and not to meddle in the internal affairs of nations on Russia's border, as well as the refusal to implement the Minsk peace agreement. The invasion of Ukraine would, I expect, never have happened if these promises had been kept. Russia has every right to feel threatened, betrayed, and angry. But to understand is not to condone. The invasion of Ukraine under post-Nuremberg laws is a criminal war of aggression. I know the instrument of war. War is not politics by other means. It is demonic. I spent 2 decades as a war correspondent in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans, where I covered the wars in Bosnia and Kosovo. I carry within me the ghosts of dozens of those swallowed up in the violence, including my close friend, Reuters correspondent Kurt Schork, who was killed in an ambush in Sierra Leone with another friend, Miguel Gil Moreno de Mora. I know the chaos and disorientation of war, the constant uncertainty and confusion. In a firefight, you are only aware of what is happening a few feet around you. You desperately, and not always successfully, struggle to figure out where the firing is coming from to avoid being hit. I have felt the helplessness and paralyzing fear, which years later descend on me like a freight train in the middle of the night, leaving me wrapped in coils of terror, my heart racing, my body dripping with sweat. I have heard the wails of those convulsed by grief as they clutch the bodies of friends and family, including children. I hear them still. It does not matter the language, Spanish, Arabic, Hebrew, Dinka, Serbo-Croatian, Albanian, Ukrainian, Russian. Death cuts through the linguistic barriers. I know what wounds look like. Legs blown off, heads imploded into a bloody, pulpy mass, gaping holes in stomachs, pools of blood, cries of the dying, sometimes for their mothers, and the smell of death, the supreme sacrifice made for flies and maggots. I was beaten by Iraqi and Saudi secret police. I was taken prisoner by the Contras in Nicaragua, who radioed back to their base in Honduras to see if they should kill me. And again in Basra, after the first Gulf War in Iraq, never knowing if I would be executed, under constant guard, and often without food, drinking out of mud puddles. The primary lesson in war is that we, as distinct individuals, do not matter. We become numbers, fodder, objects. Life, once precious and sacred, becomes meaningless, sacrificed to the insatiable appetite of Mars. No one in wartime is exempt. We were expendable. Eugene Sledge wrote of his experiences as a Marine in the South Pacific in World War II. It was difficult to accept. We come from a nation and a culture that values life and the individual. To find oneself in a situation where your life seems a little value is the ultimate in loneliness. It is a humbling experience. Sledge recalls a young Marine officer who had one ghoulish, obscene tendency of urinating in the mouths of Japanese corpses. The landscape of war is hallucinogenic. Sledge calls it the kaleidoscope of the unreal. It defies comprehension. War, like the Holocaust, as Barbara Foley wrote, is unknowable. Its full dimensions are inaccessible to the ideological framework that we have inherited from the liberal era. You have no concept of time in a firefight, a few minutes, a few hours. War in an instant obliterates homes and communities, all that was once familiar, and leaves behind smoldering ruins and a trauma that you carry for the rest of your life. I have tasted enough of war, enough of my own fear, my body turned to jelly, to know that war is always evil, the purest expression of death, dressed up in patriotic cant about liberty and democracy, and sold to the naive as a ticket to glory, honor, and courage. It is a toxic and seductive elixir. Those who survive, as Kurt Vonnegut wrote, struggle afterwards to reinvent themselves and their universe, which on some level will never make sense again. Walt Whitman, who tended wounded soldiers in hospitals during the Civil War, wrote in a heading in his notebook, "The real war will never get in the books. Its interior history will not only never be written," Whitman argues, "its practicality, minutiae of deeds and passions will never be even suggested." War destroys all systems that sustain and nurture life, familial, economic, cultural, political, environmental, and social. Once war begins, no one, even those nominally in charge of waging war, knows what will happen, how the war will develop, how it can drive armies and nations towards suicidal folly. There are no good wars, none. This includes World War II, which has been sanitized and mythologized to celebrate American heroism, purity, and goodness. If truth is the first casualty in war, ambiguity is the second. The bellicose rhetoric embraced and amplified by the American press, demonizing Vladimir Putin and elevating the Ukrainians to the status of demigods, demanding more robust military intervention, along with the crippling sanctions designed to bring down Putin's government, is infantile and dangerous. That the inverse version of this conflict is true in the Russian media fuels the insanity. There were no discussions about pacifism in the basements in Sarajevo when we were being hit with hundreds of Serbian shells a day and under constant sniper fire. It made sense to defend the city. It made sense to kill or be killed. The Bosnian Serb soldiers in the Drina Valley, Vukovar, and Srebrenica had amply demonstrated their capacity for murderous rampages, including the gunning down of hundreds of soldiers and civilians and the wholesale rape of women and girls. But this did not save any of the defenders in Sarajevo from the poison of violence, the soul-destroying force that is war. I knew a Bosnian soldier who heard a sound behind a door while patrolling on the outskirts of Sarajevo. He fired a burst from his AK-47 through the door. A delay of a few seconds in combat can mean death. When he opened the door, he found the bloody remains of a 12-year-old girl. His daughter was 12. He never recovered. The second part is called Corpses. Jessica Goodell grew up in a middle-class home near Chautauqua Lake in upstate New York. Her father was a lawyer, and her mother worked at home. But her universe fractured when she was 16 and her parents divorced. She could barely continue the motions of everyday existence. She was accepted at Ithaca College her senior year. But just before graduation, a uniformed Marine came to her high school. He told her he had come to find tough men. And what about tough women, she asked. By that afternoon, she was in the Marine recruiting office. She told the recruiter she wanted to be part of a tank crew, but was informed that women were prohibited from operating tanks. She saw a picture of a Marine standing next to a vehicle with a huge hydraulic arm and two smaller forklift arms. She signed up to be a heavy equipment mechanic, although she knew nothing about heavy equipment. 3 years later, while stationed at the Marine Corps Air Ground Combat Center in the desert town of 29 Palms, California, she volunteered to serve in the Marine Corps' first official mortuary affairs unit at El Tagram Air Base in Iraq. Her job for 8 months was to process dead Marines, collect and catalog their bodies and personal effects. She put the remains in body bags and placed the bags in metal boxes. Before being shipped to Dover Air Force Base, the boxes were stored, often for days, in a refrigerated unit known as a reefer. Her unit processed 6 suicides. The suicide notes, she told me, almost always cited hazing. Marines who were overweight or unable to do the physical training were subjected to withering verbal and physical abuse. They were called fat nasties and bags. They were assigned to other Marines as slaves. Many were forced to run until they vomited, or to bear crawl, walk on all fours, the length of a football field and back. This would be followed by sets of monkey bending down, grabbing the ankles, crouching like a baseball catcher, and then standing up again, and other exercises that went on until the Marines collapsed. Goodell's unit was sent to collect the bodies of the Marines who killed themselves. We went through everything, she told me. We would get everything that the body had on it when the Marine died. Everyone had a copy of the rules of engagement in their left breast pocket. You found notes that people had written to each other. You found lists. Lists were common, the things they wanted to do when they got home, or food they wanted to eat. The most difficult was pictures. Everyone had a picture of their wife or their kids or their family. And then you had the younger kids, who might be 18 years old, and they had prom pictures, or pictures next to what I imagine were their first cars. Everyone had a spoon in their flak jacket. There were pens and trash and wrappers and MRE food. All of it would get sent back to the Marines' homes. We all had the idea that at any point, this could be us on the table. I think Marines thought we went over there to die, and so people wrote letters saying, if I die, I want you to know I love you. I want my car to go to my younger brother, things like that. They carried those letters on their bodies. We had a Marine that we processed, and going through his wallet, we had a picture of a sonogram of a fetus his wife had sent him. And a lot of Marines had tattooed their vital information under an armpit. It was called a meat tag. Some things were not uncommon enough, like a suicide note, she continued. We had a Marine who was in a port-a-john when he blew his face off. We had another Marine who shot himself through the neck. Often they would do it in the corner of a bunker or an abandoned building. We had a couple that did it in the port-a-johns. We had to go in and peel and pull off chunks of flesh and brain tissue that had sprayed the walls. We sent the suicide notes home with the bodies. We had the paperwork to do fingerprinting, but we started getting bodies in which there weren't any hands. Or we would get bodies that were just meat. Very quickly, it became irrelevant to have a fingerprinting page to fill out. By the time we would get a body, it might have been a while, and rigor mortis had already set in. Their hands were usually clenched, as if they were still holding their rifle. We received a call one day that an IED exploded under an army convoy that was crossing a bridge. It had literally shot a 7-ton truck over the side and down into a ravine. We had on our white plastic suits and face masks and our gloves, and I was with a Marine named Pineda. I was coming around the Humvee, and there was a spot on the ground that was a circle. I looked at it, and I thought, well, something must have exploded here or near here. I looked in and saw a boot. Then I noticed the boot had a foot in it. The body of the assistant driver was trapped in the vehicle. All of his body was in the vehicle. We had to crawl in there to get it out. Pineda and I pulled the burnt upper torso from the truck. Then we removed a leg. Some of the remains had to be scooped up by putting our hands together as though we were cupping water. That was very common. A lot of the deaths were from IEDs or explosions. You might have an upper torso, but you needed to scoop the rest of the remains into a body bag. It was very common to have body bags that when you pick them up, they would sink in the middle because they were filled with flesh. She wrote, "Our platoon was to the Marines what the Marines are to much of America. We did things that had to be done, but no one wanted to know about it. The other Marines knew what we did, but they did not want to think it could happen to them. We were different from the other Marines. The smell of death permeated our clothes, hair, skin, fingers. Our camis would be stained with blood or with brains. When you scoop up the meat, it would often get on the cuffs of our shirts. You could smell it, even after you took off your gloves. We weren't washing our camis every day. Your cuff comes to your face when you eat. We had a constant smell, like rotten meat, which I guess is what it was, since often the bodies had been in the sun and the heat for a long time. The sun does horrible things to dead skin. It makes the skin slide off the body. When the man is lifted, the skin detaches itself from the layer beneath and slides around on itself. We lost two men from our original platoon who said they couldn't or wouldn't do it anymore and left. One would take a box of NyQuil tablets every day and drink as much cold medicine as he could get his hands on, but that only seemed to make matters worse. He had gone out on a particularly difficult convoy to a tank that had been blown up, obliterated except for the tracks, leaving thousands of body parts, fingers and testicles and ears and tiny scraps of tissue to be collected. It was shortly after that when I heard that he was medevaced out. One of our tougher days occurred after a platoon of Marines was on a security patrol. When they finished, they did a head count and realized that two Marines were missing. An investigation charted the route the platoon had followed, and we were sent out to find them. At one point, the Marines were walking along the shore of a lake. Navy divers accompanied us, and soon they found the two. By the time they were pulled from the lake, they had been submerged for quite a while. The water made the remains swell. One man was so bloated and misshapen that we had difficulty carrying him properly in the litter. His neck was as wide as his bloated head, and his stomach jutted out like a barrel. His testicles were the size of cantaloupes. His face was white and puffy and thick, not fat, but thick. It was unreal. He looked like a movie prop with thick, gray, waxy skin and the thick, purple lips. We couldn't stop looking at these bodies because they were so out of proportion and so disfigured, and because, still, they looked like us. One time, several Marines were killed at once. Our Marines returned to the bunker with 7 or 8 body bags filled with flesh. We had clean body bags set up so we could sort the flesh. Sometimes things come in with name tags, or sometimes one is Hispanic and you could tell who was Hispanic and who was the white guy. We tried separating flesh. It was ridiculous. We would open a body bag and there was nothing but vaporized flesh. There were not 4 hands or a whole leg in a bag. We tried to distribute the mush evenly throughout the bags. We had the last body bag come in. We opened it up and it was filled with the heads. I looked at 4 before looking away. Not only did we have to look at them, we had to pick them up and figure out who it belonged to. The eyes were looking back at us. We saw so much throughout the 8 months of the program, and we managed to get used to a lot of it. But the heads worked the other way. They affected us more strongly as time passed. On another night, she and Pineda were assigned to process a body. He was fully dressed in his camis, and his whole body was intact. His hands were lying folded across his stomach. I looked at his chest and saw that it was moving. I spun around and hid. He wasn't dead. He wasn't dead. And I didn't know what to do. The doc said, "Just wait."
"Just wait?"
"Wait for what?" I asked. "There's nothing we can do," the doc said. "Just wait." "People don't wait for this sort of thing," I protested to Pineda. "What are we waiting for? What if this Marine was your brother? Would we wait?" Pineda and I stood there for a couple of minutes that passed like hours until the young man died. I stormed out of the bunker. I just walked out, which is something Marines cannot do, but I was so angry. And I was just a kid who 2 or 3 years earlier had been playing the saxophone in high school band.
KBOO Portland.
This is KBOO Portland, Oregon.